Those of simple life, of common people, the gods lift up. Those of great pride and wealth, the gods have a tendency to cast down. So these things not only developed a great philosophy for these people, but it also strongly influenced things that were to follow. With the beginning of the Christian era, we have a great deal of development of Christian principles based upon Greek learning. The oldest known existing manuscripts of the Bible, both Testaments, Old and New, are in Greek. Nothing earlier has ever been found. Actually, therefore, most of these were probably written or compiled in Alexandria, in Egypt, which was a great Greek civilization in North Africa. We also know that Platonism, Neoplatonism, Pythagoreanism, and Neopythagoreanism, and Gnosticism were all heavily influenced by the Greek. And these various systems, variously modified with the passing of time, have become largely incorporated into the Christian way of life. The essential principles of the Greeks concerning character and conduct are the same that we still admire, even if we do not emulate them. So from the Greeks, we also have another pattern that is important, I think, and that is productivity. The individual lives to do something. It is always possible for a person to make some major improvement, and religion, therefore, is proven by growth. The individual who is better than he was before is keeping his faith better than he did before. All religion is growth, the growth by means of which the divine in the human being is released into society. Growth makes each person a prophet, makes each individual a teacher. Growth unfolds the potential that is within every person. This potential may be greater or smaller, but it is there. The potential may only help an individual to cook a better meal or to design a better house, but it will still be an improvement. It will be something gained, something added, something contributed to the common good. Therefore, every individual should make every effort possible, according to Greek thinking, to die a better person than he was born. This is quite an interesting thought if you give it care. Most people think that the individual was innocent and stainless and sinless when he's born and gradually fell into corruption. That is not quite true according to the Greek philosophy, because they do not believe that the individual coming into this world is brand new. They believe that he comes here with an unpaid debt or a need for certain further involvement. And if he has been a good person before and has been a philanthropist or generous or thoughtful person before, he will want to extend this further. So from early life, he may develop tendencies which it would indicate what he could do and can do to make a better world for himself and others. But whatever it is, each person is morally required to grow during the period of life. If he doesn't grow through the period, he is not only wasting his time, but wasting the common resources upon which we all depend for growth. If he does nothing for his life, nothing with himself, but the common things we associate today, then he is simply an expense in nature. He is costing the earth more than he is giving back. He is going gradually into a kind of psychological bankruptcy by the wasting of the resources upon which he should build a better life. If he is born with one unit of power or authority, he can become capable of multiplying it, adding to it, and leaving this life a better person than he found himself when he came in. This growth problem has always been a more or less a touchy subject. Growth nearly always interferes with selfishness. Growth nearly always interferes with the kind of notoriety that most people like. Very few people really want to be remembered because they grew spiritually. They want to be remembered because they got rich, they got famous, they got a nice fat contract or something of that nature. Success to the average person is physical success, a physical opulence. To the Greek, success came when the individual discovered the secret of the squaring of the circle or the triangulation of the right angle. He was looking for things that he could turn around and use to solve problems. There's a story of one philosopher who was hard at work when an invading army broke into his house. He was there figuring out a mathematical calculation, and a soldier came in with a drawn sword to kill him. He looked up mildly from his calculation and said, "If it's all right, will you wait a few minutes till I finish this diagram?" The soldier is said to have backed away, unable to understand the situation. But actually, in life, we have responsibilities to grow and to be part of a world that is getting better. Now, some people have trouble in getting better, but it's not all their own fault. It has been largely a fault of circumstances. The young person of Greece started in by recognizing the great institutions of Athens and the other Athenian states. He stood in the presence of the great sanctuaries. He stood before the figure of the Olympian Zeus. He saw the marvelous rituals and rites which were the joy and glory of Greece, a glory that caused many Roman emperors to come there simply to see the magnificence of the dedication to the divine plan. Growing up in this atmosphere in which everyone else was at least respectful of realities, that the great joy of life was to be in the presence of these beauties and these joys, it was a different thing. These young people could grow up with a greater likelihood of being dedicated to useful purposes. We know now that there's a great excitement, for example, about the Olympic Games, that there have been things happening that were very disquieting and indicated wrongdoing in the part of athletes and so on. Well, the Greeks had their Olympic Games, and the way that led to the great Colosseum was it was lined with tablets on each side. And if any athlete performed an error, an intentional crime, or was unfair, unreasonable, or used any means to win that was not right, his name was carved on a stone and stood up by the entranceway to the Colosseum, and he was held to be a detriment to society, and his name was perpetuated for his misdeed. This type of thing would never happen today, but at the same time, it was something that the young Athenian grew up with. He also attended certain other festivals which were intended primarily for the learned. He saw a crowd of maybe thousands of people pick up a poet on their shoulders and carry him triumphantly through the streets of Athens because he had written a poem that was outstanding. The poem was good. He was not famous because of a cheap poem. But the whole population recognized the great poet as equivalent to greatness in any other field. A man might run a race and win. A man might write a poem and win. And both were equal, because both were exceptional in some respect. This type of thinking has sort of faded out of our lives. And as it faded away, there were more and more compromises between the integrities of nature and the concepts of ancient thinking. Today we have a strong scientific body of people who are trained in sciences and who have built upon the Greek foundations vast laboratory experiments and based upon Greek principles have put ships into space. All of this is remarkable, and these people are held in great esteem for their skill, their courage, and their intelligence. But unless they fulfill the Greek requirement, they are not completely what they ought to be. For you can ask each one of these scientists, each one of these inventors, each one of these research men, do you love humanity sufficiently to do all this work for nothing and simply turn it into only one type of thing, something that will advance peace, harmony, brotherhood, insight, and the necessities of life for all people? Will you devote your life and all your research funds to find a way to end poverty or reduce crime or cure suffering without thought or challenge of reward? If that was our thought that we have now, as it was in the clinics of Hippocrates, we might then say that these people might be worth a very special consideration. The individual who gives all gains all in a strange way. But today we are not thinking through to the source of things. And because of that, we have not found the place for the divine plan among the archives of the learned today. We know there are many people who appreciate these things. We realize that philosophies involving spiritual growth are becoming more common and more available all the time. The orthodoxies of the past are more or less breaking down, and those that are essentially true are being dignified and elevated. But still, we live in a world in which our mathematics has not yet found God. We're not really looking for him. It is assumed that he doesn't exist. Or if he does, he is where no one can understand him, no one can ever find him, and no one has any right to depend upon him for anything. The fact of the matter is, everyone has the duty to depend upon ultimate life for everything, whether we know it or not. The food we eat, the air we breathe, the water we contaminate, all these things belong to a power greater than ourselves. They belong to an eternal principle of truth. They belong to the great powers that rule the world. And it is very definitely important that we begin to think in these terms and meet some of the problems of daily life. Now, Platonic philosophy itself is a rather interesting thing. Plato was a man who lived to be just about 81 years. And therefore, he completed the great climactic of the ancients. When he reached around 78, 79, he became mentally tired. He had taught all his life. He had many strong disciples, but he was having trouble with Aristotle, who finally walked out and left him. And he was also constantly criticized and condemned, and he was too tired to answer back. But finally, before his passing, Plato made a great adjustment, which very few people know about or have thought about, and that is that he came to the simple conclusion that all knowledge in every branch and in every feeling exists for one purpose only, that we may find God. He became a mystic, a very powerful mystic, and the mysticism which consummated his career was preserved for us by Proclus, a Platonic descendant, in his famous work on the theology of Plato. Plato turned in the end from philosophy to theology. He said that or felt that making this turn was not a reduction, was not an evasion of philosophy, and was not against philosophy, for he decided that science, philosophy, and the arts all have the same purpose, that the individual shall come to know the eternal source of life, love it, respect it, and live to serve it. This is not exactly the same thinking that is in his work, The Republic, or other essays which he compiled, but it has become what his closest disciples realized to be tremendously important and became the basis of the Neoplatonism of Alexandria under Plotinus and other Neoplatonists, Iamblichus and Ammonius Saccas. The great work of the Platonic school, therefore, was consummated in the fact that philosophy is the handmaiden of religion. That no matter how wise you become, you can never be safe until love takes over. Up to that time, existence will always remain precarious. And there is no advantage, no skill, no certainty in debating and arguing these matters. There is no way in which one individual can explain to another the full mystery of life. Each one must find it for himself in his own way. But through philosophy, which joins the mind to imponderables, mathematics, which brings the mind into the certainties of science, and music and art and the arts in general, all these help the individual to mature his own life until at last he can place his faith completely in the hands of God. Pythagoras and his disciples always danced and sang together at dawn. And we are told that Socrates, in spite of the fact he was not exactly a beautiful person physically, having a tendency to be a hunchback and also to have his short legged and so forth, until he looked more like a gnome or the old deity Salinas than he did like a philosopher. But Socrates didn't care how he looked. It was the way he felt that counted. So he went out in the morning also and danced about with his disciples. There are reports from outside areas that the dance was not perfect, but nobody cared, least of all Socrates. He had no pride as we know it. He simply felt that there were things to be done and that he was going to try and do them. And he did them to the rest of his life. But anyway, the point that we need to make now, I think also, is that the type of philosophy that was developed by the Greeks through their sciences and their arts was a philosophy of basic happiness. In other words, Socrates wasn't unhappy when he died. He was perfectly content because all of these things are simply interludes. The moment you get a deep enough footing in the realities of life, fear ceases. There's no longer anything to be really terribly unhappy about. The only thing we can do if something is wrong and try and fix it. If we come to a person in grief, we try to console and comfort them. And if we have moments of grief ourselves, we will in due time console ourselves from the resources within ourselves. In the meantime, we will go on living as happily, constructively, and even humorously as we can. The Greeks were great humorists. They had some of the wittiest stories that have ever been known. And the most delightful part has always been that they were so definitely inspired by a philosophical understanding. Diogenes and Plato had a little feud on, because Diogenes insisted on thinking that Plato considered himself to be a superior person and be a little snobbish and so on. And of course that was worse than heresy as far as Diogenes was concerned. And one day Plato got himself a new cloak. Where it came from and how he got it, we don't know. But it was a nice looking cloak, and it was long enough so that the tail of it brushed on the ground. Diogenes walked along behind him for a while, and when they got to a muddy spot, he jumped up and down on the tail of Plato's cloak. And he said, "Thus I step on Plato's pride." Plato turned to him and said, "Diogenes, yes. And how proud you are that you have done it." This type of humor has been very famous and very telling and always a delight, because it shows that these minds never got soggy. It's very hard to imagine a Greek philosopher who was ever soggy in his thinking. He might have all kinds of strange and interesting beliefs, but he was always a human being. He was always a person who could see the light side of things, could make the best of situations, and could turn the edge of something to make everybody feel good about it. And on another occasion, there was a philosopher sitting in a little tavern that was probably the 300 or 400 B.C. version of the modern hot dog stand. He was sitting there eating something that was equivalent to one of our quick sandwiches. And along came one of the archons. The archons, of course, were the leaders of the state. They had a little something to do with the idea of senators or something of that nature. But they were the rulers of the Athenian Commonwealth. And this archon came by looking very sedate, very smug, and very self-important. And the old philosopher sitting at the lunch counter turned to him and said, "Hail, brother, come and have sandwich with me." And he looked at there's something worse than Macmillan ever looked. And and he turned his head away and wouldn't go and join the philosopher with his sandwich. So the philosopher called after him, "Are you not the servant of the people?" And the archon said, "Yes." And then this philosopher said, "If you are a servant of the people, are you too good to eat where your masters eat?" No, it's not just certain what happened as a result of that, but it is supposed to have quieted the situation for the moment. So there are all kinds of delightful things that have come down to us from these very wise and very witty people. And I think to try to understand the situation in terms of our present thinking, I believe that one or two things should happen. Maybe they will, they probably will, because man is growing regardless of the unfortunate things that are done to him as he tries to grow, things that are interfering with his growth. I think that each individual should be taught that to learn is always an invitation to a larger dimension of insights and understanding. The child who learns the multiplication table should not come to the conclusion that its only purpose is to add up his grocery bill. He should learn to know that everything he learns is a fragment of the great unknown completeness which we are all seeking. Everything that we learn should be used to increase learning and not merely to make things more convenient in our daily relationships. It doesn't mean that they cannot be convenient, but that is not the end. The individual who gets a graduation mark, even from a grammar school, but does not have at least a feeling, an instinct that tells him that what he is learning and what he has learned has a meaning greater than merely the process of trying to graduate so he can get a job. All these things are doorways. Everything we learn is a doorway. The more we fail to learn, the more we keep the doors locked. Every simple thing that comes to us in the daily existences is a symbol, an emblem, a significator of something greater. That all things go to prove in the end the reality of one thing. And that one thing is the massive glory of the plan to which we belong. Somewhere we must finally realize that we are uniquely favored by some mysterious power that has given us the right and the ability to seek truth, worship and venerate God, and live together in peace, contentment, and amity. These things are possible. These are the rewards we are seeking. But before we can gain these greater ends, we must gradually outgrow the false ends which we have substituted for them. There is no crime in being of comfortable means, but this is not the great virtue. The virtue is to grow. What we have, we will have to leave behind. What we are is eternal for us. So we must do something for the eternity. We must try in one way or another to become suitable to a greater dimension of existence. And I think the Greeks were, of all the people we know, were the best fitted at that. They had very little negative theology. They had really no worry much about hell or damnation. It wasn't part of their philosophy. They did not fear truth. They did not fear God. They would like, rather, to venerate, to accept and understand. The great figures that they created for their shrines and temples became symbols of living power, of living beings. And this quest for them, this quest for the living beings, went on through the great schools of learning which the Greeks developed. This Grecian system went finally a little bit into Rome, but did not really stay there too well. The Romans were not of this mind at all. From the Romans, we may have developed some of the things that we consider as practical. Now, there seems to be a great question as to what is practical. Whether it is practical to go as the Romans did to conquer the world, or whether it is better to do the old Greek method of conquering yourself. But in any respect, the Romans, for a time at least, had a certain veneration for the Greeks. Many of the Roman families had Greek tutors for their children. And particularly in the failing days of Rome, when it became obvious that things had all gone bad, the Romans became more interested in the Greek philosophies and in the Greek tradition, especially in Alexandria and Athens. As to the problem of the Greek ethics, the mystery system really lived and survived the collapse of the Roman Empire and the final fall of Greece itself. Any person, for instance, who was suspected of a crime or of a misdemeanor was refused admission into the mysteries. Everyone had to tell the full and honest story of his life if he sought to enter a sanctuary devoted to religion. He had to admit all the little mistakes that he had made, all the little crimes that he had created for others. Perhaps this was the beginning of what we call for centuries the confessional. He had to confess. If he did not confess, he was not acceptable. And it became interesting in one way or another because many Romans, all Greeks, who were accused of secret crimes or misdemeanors, placed the matter before the mysteries. In other words, if they were being accused of dishonesty, they might go to the temple and ask to be initiated. The temple would make its own examination of every detail of the case. It would never tell what it found. But if the individual had been guilty of any evil action of importance, he would be refused. If, however, this person, having appealed to the mysteries, was accepted, then the legislative system and the legal system dismissed all charges against him, because it was assumed that in the state mysteries, if he had made any prevarication of any kind, the temple would be responsible for discovering it, and had means to do so, including probably extrasensory perception. So if he passed that test, any crime or case against him was discontinued. Nero had a great desire to be an initiate. He went to Athens, but when he heard the rules, he went back to Rome. He was rejected. And it was something even in those days. Athens at that time was under the control of Rome. It was interesting that at that time, Greece refused to accept as a candidate the emperor of Rome. But it shows the way in which, for most part, their whole system was developed. They tried very, very hard to make it true and factual. In the course of so doing, they made many discoveries relating to common personal affairs, which are worth mentioning, perhaps. Lycurgus, for example, was a disciplinarian. He said there's only one way to keep a country healthy, and that is to make sure that it keeps the rules. And also, to keep a country healthy, it must respect the rules. And it must also establish these rules so firmly that the government itself cannot break them. If the leaders are corrupted, the people will not stand. If the leaders keep their own rules completely and exactly, and discipline their lives in principles of integrity and courage, the government will survive. Well, that's a thought that has come down for a long time, that perhaps has meaning more and more to us. We are beginning to see the very problems that the Greeks feared and tried to prevent. But of course they were gone long ago, and the changing habits and practices of the world no longer remembers them very clearly. I had the privilege of representing Greece in the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago. And at that time, through our good friend, the Archbishop, later Patriarch, Athenagoras I, we gave a summary on Greek philosophy before the entire group, several thousand persons who attended the session. And that we largely emphasized the importance of Greek thought in the regulation of modern Greek affairs in the United States, and also the importance of the philosophical Platonic discussion of government and the rulerships of peoples. That Plato was one of the first to advocate or delineate a proper government, and his procedures have never yet been questioned. The Greek community seemed to enjoy the whole procedure. And it gave me an opportunity to point out that while we are looking for background history to defend our present action, we should look where some of the better history is, not on the wars with Napoleon and Caesar or the conquests of Alexander, but in the system of scientific, philosophical, and religious integration, which for many centuries gave the world over 600 immortal thinkers, the greatest single group of enlightened human beings of which we have record. And it all began with the understanding and the background philosophy that the individual must believe in a divine power at the source of life and must bind his conduct to the laws of that power as they are revealed to him through the operating laws of nature. If he can come to these conclusions and apply them, he will find that the government that existing forever in space must be obeyed, and that man will never make an enduring government that differs from or varies from the government of the eternal plan. This, I think, the Greeks have told us, and I think a lot of people are beginning to appreciate it. Thank you very much.